Okay, there it comes.
Well, if you end up with the you know, a male and female or a pregnant snake to start with, they start reproducing. And the snakes are predators. All snakes are predators. They go in, they eat the birds, they can climb trees, so there's no defense just by nesting in a tree. And they're eating birds and lizards all through the Pacific now, every island they've gone to. And as long as it's someplace warm and humid, they can survive. And it's kind of scary because our culture is just moving all the time. We have ships and airplanes going back and forth. And unless you check for the spread of these things. They found a brown tree snake in Texas last year on the Texas coast at Ingleside. There's a naval station. And a person had come from, I don't remember which island in the Pacific, Guam or Saipan, something like that. His furniture and everything had been crated for 6 months. And they unpacked it at Ingleside and found a live snake in there. Well, South Texas is hot and humid. It's tropical. Brown tree mm-hmm. snakes could survive. And they could go through. While most of the birds in the United States are adapted for predators, whether it be bobcats or snakes, things like that, they're not adapted for brown tree snakes, and that's a major problem. You know, even here in the United States, house cats are a major problem because house cats will climb trees and stalk birds. House cats are descended from a wild cat that you'd find in Europe and Asia, not the United States, so they're not adapted for it.
Our cats bring home a lot of birds.
Right. And,
a lot of them.
You know, when they're bringing home house sparrows and stuff, it's really not affecting the world. But the trouble is when the cats go out into wild areas and hedgerows and so forth that are, you know, so-called natural habitat, and they wreck havoc.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love cats. I love having cats and dogs around, but they shouldn't be wild.
Mm-hmm.
Well, imagine on an island where nothing is used to having any predator around, and a cat can just clean up real quick. So a lot of things have gone extinct on the islands.
Now, I may not be correct in saying this, but I think, wasn't the dodo an
right.
island bird?
Right.
What can you tell me about how that bird got to be extinct? I know it didn't fly, but that's about all I know about it.
It was a flightless bird. It was reported to have been not too smart, which is like people being dumb as a dodo and so forth. They were real easy to kill. You just kind of walk up and hit them over the head with a stick, and you have dinner. They were a good-sized bird, about like a turkey or something. There was a lot of meat on them, so the sailors would naturally eat them. And then things would get loose on the island, like rats and so forth, which would then eat their eggs, and all these introduced animals that would go along. So the dodo went extinct just shortly after Europeans got to the islands. It's just almost overnight type thing. And once they're gone, they're gone.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned whooping cranes. In the United States, what other species of birds are... I know having 100 birds is, a very low number. Are there any other species of birds that are that low in number or that are in extreme danger right now?
There are the Atwater's prairie chicken, which again is a subspecies. It's not the full species itself. They are probably going to go extinct in the next few years. Their numbers are just so low. Even though we're trying to save them, we're setting aside land for them, we're stopping people from bothering them. But once your numbers get down low enough, it's just next to impossible to come back. Whooping cranes were a great success story. Let's see, as far as numbers being, California condors are only about 50 birds, all of which are in zoos. They captured the last condors back in the 80s. There were only like 6 in the wild. They went out and caught all of them and put them in zoos so they have captive breeding programs. And they've since been releasing South American condors in California. It's kind of a practice to see, because there are more South American condors, the Andean condor, in California. And just seeing, are we doing this right? Is this the right way to do it? We'll practice with this one. Because if they die, it's bad, but it's not as bad as if they're the only ones. And now they've actually released some of the California condors into the wild in controlled areas, where they go in and raise them on a little platform that looks like a cave type thing. There's no human interaction. The people are always behind walls where they drop the food, or they go in at night when the birds are asleep. So the birds won't habituate to people. We want them to be scared of us. so they don't land in front of your car when you're going 60 miles an hour and things like that. With condors, a big problem. Their food supply has changed. People have gone in and settled the mountains of California, got rid of the large animals. And the main thing that's killing them off is lead. You go out hunting, you shoot a deer, the deer gets away. Condor is just a big vulture. He comes along, he's eating the meat. They need grit in their crop to, or the, to their juicer to grind things up. So they root through a carcass looking for bone fragments and things. They find a chunk of lead. Lead's hard, feels like bone. They swallow it. Lead ruins their digestive system, so they can eat all day long, but they don't get anything out of it, and they starve to death. And all the dead condors that they were finding in the 70s and 80s had lead in their system. So you can't stop hunting. I mean, it's just, it's part of life. And we shouldn't stop hunting. Animals would overpopulate because the predators are gone. But lead is a big problem. But anyway, back to your original questions. Condors are ones that are, their numbers are just horribly low. The Atwater's prairie chicken, snail kites in Florida, the numbers are dangerously low. I'm trying to think numbers right off. There are a couple of warbler species that are very, very low. And then other things that are endangered, their numbers aren't, you know, down to 10 or anything like that, for the fact that they only nest in one area, and that area is endangered. So things like golden cheek warblers in Texas and black-capped vireos, they need successional growth where there's been a fire, everything's burnt, new brush is coming up. Well, people don't like fires. They think it's bad. You know, Smokey Bear told us that fires are bad. Well, fires have been burning for millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, and people went around and put them out. Well, these birds have adapted for that. And the other problem is, like the golden cheek warblers need cedar. Well, people like to live in the cedar breaks in Texas. You have nice hills, you live out in the country, you spend $1 million, buy the property, put up a house, chop down trees, no more warblers. So their numbers are low, but not low enough that you compare with whooping cranes and things. I'm just trying to think of numbers that are real, real low. My mind's, I'm sorry.
How low do their numbers have to be put on the endangered list? Is there a specific number?
No, it's just where they do research and study and look at it and basically say that their numbers are down low enough that they could go extinct. And we're not talking like an actual number. Mm-hmm. We're just looking at, you know, even if their numbers are high, are they in an area like the spotted owl? There are lots of spotted owls out there, but the trouble is they live in old-growth forest. In old-growth forest, there's only like 1% left of what was here 200 years ago, and once that last 1% is gone, the northern spotted owl is gone too. Well, right now, if we just stopped cutting down trees, there would be lots of spotted owls out there. Their numbers are high enough, but you have to have them protected so that you don't go and get rid of the ones that are there. So no, it's not like there's a set number that if they reach 1,000 individuals, they're in danger. It's a lot of study involved and looking at the risks that are involved.
And when they get placed on that list, their entire habitat also gets placed on the list?
Right. Well, where it's not a fixed thing. Like the golden cheek warblers need cedar trees, and there's not a law that says you can't go cut down cedar trees. What they do is they document that there are golden cheek warblers nesting in that area. And then it becomes a legal aspect that you can't cut down trees in that area. Up in the northwest, they have some areas where you can't cut down a tree within so many feet of a spotted owl nest, things like that. It doesn't say you can't cut down trees. Mm-hmm. We couldn't survive without mm-hmm. things like that. And the laws would never get passed in those cases. And that's a major problem with environmental issues, is it becomes polarized. People think that if we have the spotted owl as an endangered species, we'll never be able to cut down another tree. That's not what the law says. That's not what the scientists say. That's not what the government says. But if you're the timber industry, you get scared and you say things like that.
Okay. I know that... Well, I'm from out west, so I know that there's a lot of laws up in Colorado, and there's a lot of laws passed out there to protect wildlife. how does the South compare? Because I haven't heard as many down here, and I don't know if that's just because I haven't been down here as long, or what regions of the United States are bigger on passing environmental laws?
To be honest, I moved to Alabama 2 months ago, so I'm still learning. Well, like, federal laws are nationwide.
Right.
The thing with Colorado is still being settled, basically. Alabama was settled 200 years ago, so there's a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
There are protected areas in Alabama. You have national forests, you have state parks, you have wildlife refuges. Wheeler Wildlife Refuge is up by Decatur. It was set up for ducks and geese. There are hundreds of ducks and geese spend the winter there, and set aside for those types of things. So yeah, the South is, I mean, the whole country, there's wildlife refuges around. As far as the state laws and how well they're enforced, I really couldn't tell you. That's half of it, is not so much what the laws are, but how well they enforce them. I knew of cases back in Texas where a man was going out and shooting any bird he wanted to, but the man also owned most of the property in the county. And when someone reported him to, like, the state level, they said, no, you have to start the report with the local game warden. Well, the man owned the local game warden. So the laws were on the books. They were there. It was violating federal laws, mm-hmm. but they weren't being enforced. That's a big problem.
I'm going to backtrack a little
sure.
bit, because I wrote this down and I just skipped over it. But you'd mentioned that the condor you'd mentioned, they are all in zoos now, and they're breeding them in zoos.
Right.
I know with some of the animals that they try to do that with, they have a lot of difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the same with birds, or are birds?
Yes, you have to. Well, condors, they've had real good luck breeding them. But one of the things they're very, very careful with these days, it wasn't always that way, is making sure that they're keeping genetic diversity. That's the problem, like with the whooping cranes, when there are only 15 of them. That means that brother and sister and cousins are breeding together. We know that's not good in people. That's why we have laws set up to prevent that type of thing. It's not good in the wild either. If you have, two individuals that are closely related, I'm not talking brother and sister here, but just they came down from the same family tree, their odds of them having similar genes is pretty good. And if there's any defective gene in there and they breed, the offspring are likely going to have this genetic defect. So with the condors, they're very, very careful. They know all the lineage of these birds. They know who their parents were, who their parents' parents were. And they make sure that they're moving back and forth and they're not breeding the same birds all the time to create that diversity. The black-footed ferrets in Wyoming, getting into mammals now, not birds, but they thought black-footed ferrets were extinct. You'd looked in any book and it says they're extinct. They went extinct 20 years ago. There are no more. Well, they found some in, the mid-80s. And at Meteetse, Wyoming, some farmer's dog brought in a dead black-footed ferret. And it's like, you know, everybody's like, oh my gosh, you killed it. And they're like, no, we have some. You know, you couldn't have killed it if there were none. So they went out and caught them all and put them into captivity. That's a real good example of a good program. They had their problems. Somehow canine distemper got into the black-footed ferrets and killed a lot of the ones that they had in captivity. So now their workers, you can't. This was when I was up there in the 80s. It might have changed since then. But
Francis Moe, please come to the museum's admissions desk. Francis, please.
So now, like, if you've been around a dog in the last 24 hours, you can't go into the ferret thing. You have to be kind of quarantined. You have to be disinfected before you go in there, put on lab suits, and even then you're not really handling them directly. So there's a lot of precautions taken. With the whooping cranes, it's done that way. Problem they have with whooping cranes and breeding them is, like most animals, the male and female have to go through a ritual before mating. With cranes, they're almost like humans. They have a whole courtship phase. One of their big things is they dance. Literally, they dance. They throw their wings up, they jump in the air, they flip, and we're talking a bird that's 5 foot tall doing this. And it's really elaborate, courtship that they go through. Well, that's what brings the female, makes her ready to mate. So if you just go and you have some semen from a male whooping crane and you want to artificially inseminate the female, you can do that all day long. But unless she's ready for it, she's not going to be fertile. She's not going to have eggs produced. So they've had researchers go out and dance with the cranes. And the bird's like, well, if he's dancing, you know, and it gets them set up for it. So there's a lot of things like that they have to do. It's a complicated process. With the cranes, it's been pretty successful.